Chapter 44. Captain Mitchell, pacing the wharf, was asking himself the same question. There was always the doubt whether the warning of the Esmeralda telegraphist a fragmentary and interrupted message had been properly understood. However, the good man had made up his mind not to go to bed till daylight, if even then. He imagined himself to have rendered an enormous service to Charles Gould. When he thought of the saved silver, he rubbed his hands together with satisfaction. In his simple way, he was proud at being a party to this extremely clever expedient. It was he who had given it a practical shape by suggesting the possibility of intercepting at sea the northbound steamer. And it was advantageous to his company too, which would have lost a valuable freight if the treasure had been left ashore to be confiscated. The pleasure of disappointing the Monterists was also very great. Authoritative by temperament and the long habit of command, Captain Mitchell was no democrat. He even went so far as to profess a contempt for parliamentarism itself. His Excellency Don Vincent Ribiera, he used to say, whom I and that fellow of mine, Nostromo, had the honor, sir, and the pleasure of saving from a cruel death, deferred too much to his Congress. It was a mistake, a distinct mistake, sir. The guileless old seaman superintending the O.S.S.N. service imagined that the last 3 days had exhausted every startling surprise the political life of Costaguana could offer. He used to confess afterwards that the events which followed surpassed his imagination. To begin with, Sulaco, because of the seizure of the cables and the disorganization of the steam service, remained for a whole fortnight cut off from the rest of the world like a besieged city. One would not have believed it possible, but so it was, sir. A full fortnight. The account of the extraordinary things that happened during that time, and the powerful emotions he experienced, acquired a comic impressiveness from the pompous manner of his personal narrative. He opened it always by assuring his hearer that he was in the thick of things from first to last. Then he would begin by describing the getting away of the silver, and his natural anxiety lest his fellow in charge of the lighter should make some mistake. Apart from the loss of so much precious metal, the life of Senior Martin Decad, an agreeable, wealthy, and well-informed young gentleman, would have been jeopardized through his falling into the hands of his political enemies. Captain Mitchell also admitted that in his solitary vigil on the wharf he had felt a certain measure of concern for the future of the whole country. A feeling, sir, he explained, perfectly comprehensible in a man properly grateful for the many kindnesses received from the best families of merchants and other native gentlemen of independent means, who, barely saved by us from the excesses of the mob, seemed, to my mind's eye, destined to become the prey in person and fortune of the native soldiery, which, as is well known, behave with regrettable barbarity to the inhabitants during their civil commotions. And then, sir, there were the Goulds, for both of whom, man and wife, I could not but entertain the warmest feelings deserved by their hospitality and kindness. I felt, too, the dangers of the gentlemen of the Amarillo Club, who had made me honorary member, and had treated me with uniform regard and civility, both in my capacity of consular agent and as superintendent of an important steam service. Miss Antonia Avellanos, the most beautiful and accomplished young lady whom it had ever been my privilege to speak to, was not a little in my mind, I confess. How the interests of my company would be affected by the impending change of officials claimed a large share of my attention to. In short, sir, I was extremely anxious and very tired, as you may suppose, by the exciting and memorable events in which I had taken my little part. The company's building containing my residence was within 5 minutes' walk. With the attraction of some supper, and of my hammock, I always take my nightly rest in a hammock, as the most suitable to the climate. But somehow, sir, though evidently I could do nothing for anyone by remaining about, I could not tear myself away from that wharf, where the fatigue made me stumble painfully at times. The night was excessively dark, the darkest I remember in my life. So that I began to think that the arrival of the transport from Esmeralda could not possibly take place before daylight, owing to the difficulty of navigating the gulf. The mosquitoes bit like fury. We have been infested here with mosquitoes before the late improvements. A peculiar harbor brand, sir, renowned for its ferocity. They were like a cloud about my head, and I shouldn't wonder that, but for their attacks I would have dozed off as I walked up and down, and got a heavy fall. I kept on smoking cigar after cigar, more to protect myself from being eaten up alive than from any real relish for the weed. Then, sir, when perhaps for the 20th time I was approaching my watch to the lighted end in order to see the time, and observing with surprise that it wanted yet 10 minutes to midnight, I heard the splash of a ship's propeller, an unmistakable sound to a sailor's ear on such a calm night. It was faint indeed, because they were advancing with precaution and dead slow, both on account of the darkness, and from their desire of not revealing too soon their presence. A very unnecessary care, because, I verily believe, in all the enormous extent of this harbor I was the only living soul about. Even the usual staff of watchmen and others had been absent from their posts for several nights owing to the disturbances. I stood stock still, after dropping and stamping out my cigar, a circumstance highly agreeable, I should think, to the mosquitoes, if I may judge from the state of my face next morning. But that was a trifling inconvenience in comparison with the brutal proceedings I became victim of on the part of Satillo. Something utterly inconceivable, sir. More like the proceedings of a maniac than the action of a sane man, however lost to all sense of honor and decency. But Satillo was furious at the failure of his thievish scheme. And this Captain Mitchell was right. Satillo was indeed infuriated. Captain Mitchell, however, had not been arrested at once. A vivid curiosity induced him to remain on the wharf, which is nearly 400 feet long, to see, or rather hear, the whole process of disembarkation. Concealed by the railway truck used for the silver, which had been run back afterwards to the shore end of the jetty, Captain Mitchell saw the small detachment thrown forward, pass by, taking different directions upon the plain. Meantime, the troops were being landed and formed into a column, whose head crept up gradually so close to him that he made it out, barring nearly the whole width of the wharf, only a very few yards from him. Then the low, shuffling, murmuring, clinking sound ceased, and the whole mass remained for about an hour motionless and silent, awaiting the return of the scouts. On land nothing was to be heard except the deep baying of the mastiffs at the railway yards, answered by the faint barking of the curs infesting the outer limits of the town. A detached knot of dark shapes stood in front of the head of the column. Presently the picket at the end of the wharf began to challenge in undertone single figures approaching from the plain. Those messengers sent back from the scouting parties flung to their comrades brief sentences and passed on rapidly, becoming lost in the great motionless mass, to make their report to the staff. It occurred to Captain Mitchell that his position could become disagreeable and perhaps dangerous, when suddenly, at the head of the jetty, there was a shout of command, a bugle call, followed by a stir and a rattling of arms, and a murmuring noise that ran right up the column. Nearby a loud voice directed hurriedly, "Push that railway car out of the way." At the rush of bare feet, to execute the order, Captain Mitchell skipped back a pace or two. The car, suddenly impelled by many hands, flew away from him along the rails, and before he knew what had happened he found himself surrounded and seized by his arms, and the collar of his coat. "We have caught a man hiding here, mitenient," cried one of his captors. hold him on one side till the rearguard comes along, answered the voice. The whole column streamed past Captain Mitchell at a run, the thundering noise of their feet dying away suddenly on the shore. His captors held him tightly, disregarding his declaration that he was an Englishman and his loud demands to be taken at once before their commanding officer. Finally he lapsed into dignified silence. With a hollow rumble of wheels on the planks, a couple of field guns, dragged by hand, rolled by. Then, after a small body of men had marched past escorting four or five figures which walked in advance, with a jingle of steel scabbards, he felt a tug at his arms, and was ordered to come along. During the passage from the wharf to the custom house, it is to be feared that Captain Mitchell was subjected to certain indignities at the hands of the soldiers, such as jerks, thumps on the neck, forcible application of the butt of a rifle to the small of his back. Their ideas of speed were not in accord with his notion of his dignity. He became flustered, flushed, and helpless. It was as if the world were coming to an end. The long building was surrounded by troops, which were already piling arms by companies and preparing to pass the night lying on the ground in their ponchos with their sacks under their heads. Corporals moved with swinging lanterns, posting sentries all round the walls, wherever there was a door or an opening. Satillo was taking his measures to protect his conquest, as if it had indeed contained the treasure. His desire to make his fortune at one audacious stroke of genius had overmastered his reasoning faculties. He would not believe in the possibility of failure. The mere hint of such a thing made his brain reel with rage. Every circumstance pointing to it appeared incredible. The statement of Hirsch, which was so absolutely fatal to his hopes, could by no means be admitted. It is true, too, that Hirsch's story had been told so incoherently, with such excessive signs of distraction, that it really looked improbable. It was extremely difficult, as the saying is, to make head or tail of it. On the bridge of the steamer, directly after his rescue, Satillo and his officers, in their impatience and excitement, would not give the wretched man time to collect such few wits as remained to him. He ought to have been quieted, soothed, and reassured, whereas he had been roughly handled, cuffed, shaken, and addressed in menacing tones. His struggles, his wriggles, his attempts to get down on his knees, followed by the most violent efforts to break away, as if he meant incontinently to jump overboard, his shrieks and shrinkings and cowering wild glances had filled them first with amazement, then with a doubt of his genuineness, as men are wont to suspect the sincerity of every great passion. His Spanish, too, became so mixed up with German that the better half of his statements remained incomprehensible. He tried to propitiate them by calling them Achuel Gebrun Aaron, which in itself sounded suspicious. When admonished sternly not to trifle, he repeated his entreaties and protestations of loyalty and innocence again in German, obstinately, because he was not aware in what language he was speaking. His identity, of course, was perfectly known as an inhabitant of Esmeralda, but this made the matter no clearer. As he kept on forgetting Deckard's name, mixing him up with several other people he had seen in the Casa Gould, it looked as if they all had been in the lighter together, and for a moment Satillo thought that he had drowned every prominent Ribierist of Sulaco. The improbability of such a thing threw a doubt upon the whole statement. Hirsch was either mad or playing a part, pretending fear and distraction on the spur of the moment to cover the truth. Satillo's rapacity, excited to the highest pitch by the prospect of an immense booty, could believe in nothing adverse. This Jew might have been very much frightened by the accident, but he knew where the silver was concealed, and had invented this story, with his Jewish cunning, to put him entirely off the track as to what had been done. Satillo had taken up his quarters on the upper floor in a vast apartment with heavy black beams. But there was no ceiling, and the eye lost itself in the darkness under the high pitch of the roof. The thick shutters stood open. On a long table could be seen a large inkstand, some stumpy, inky quill pens, and two square wooden boxes, each holding half a hundredweight of sand. Sheets of gray coarse official paper best strewed the floor. It must have been a room occupied by some higher official of the customs, because a large leathern armchair stood behind the table, with other high-backed chairs scattered about. A net hammock was swung under one of the beams for the official's afternoon siesta, no doubt. A couple of candles stuck in two tall iron candlesticks gave a dim reddish light. The colonel's hat, sword, and revolver lay between them, and a couple of his more trusty officers lounged gloomily against the table. The colonel threw himself into the armchair, and a big negro with a sergeant's stripes on his ragged sleeve, kneeling down, pulled off his boots. Satillo's ebony mustache contrasted violently with the livid coloring of his cheeks. His eyes were somber, and as if sunk very far into his head. He seemed exhausted by his perplexities, languid with disappointment. But when the sentry on the landing thrust his head in to announce the arrival of a prisoner, he revived at once. "Let him be brought in," he shouted, fiercely. The door flew open, and Captain Mitchell, bareheaded, his waistcoat open, the bow of his tie under his ear, was hustled into the room. Satillo recognized him at once. He could not have hoped for a more precious capture. Here was a man who could tell him, if he chose, everything he wished to know, and directly the problem of how best to make him talk to the point, presented itself to his mind. The resentment of a foreign nation had no terrors for Satillo. The might of the whole armed Europe would not have protected Captain Mitchell from insults and ill usage, so well as the quick reflection of Satillo, that this was an Englishman who would most likely turn obstinate under bad treatment, and become quite unmanageable. At all events, the colonel smoothed the scowl on his brow. "What? The excellent Senior Mitchell?" he cried, in affected dismay. The pretended anger of his swift advance, and of his shout, "Release the caballero at once," was so effective, that the astounded soldiers positively sprang away from their prisoner. Thus suddenly deprived of forcible support, Captain Mitchell reeled, as though about to fall. Satillo took him familiarly under the arm, led him to a chair, waved his hand at the room. "Gee, go out, all of you," he commanded. When they had been left alone, he stood looking down, irresolute and silent, watching till Captain Mitchell had recovered his power of speech. Here in his very grasp was one of the men concerned in the removal of the silver. Satillo's temperament was of that sort that he experienced an ardent desire to beat him, just as formerly when negotiating with difficulty a loan from the cautious Anzani, his fingers always itched to take the shopkeeper by the throat. As to Captain Mitchell, the suddenness, unexpectedness, and general inconceivableness of this experience had confused his thoughts. Moreover, he was physically out of breath. "I've been knocked down 3 times between this and the wharf," he gasped out at last. "S somebody shall be made to pay for this." He had certainly stumbled more than once, and had been dragged along for some distance, before he could regain his stride. With his recovered breath, his indignation seemed to madden him. He jumped up, crimson, all his white hair bristling, his eyes glaring vengefully, and shook violently the flaps of his ruined waistcoat before the disconcerted Satillo. "L, look! Those uniform thieves of yours downstairs have robbed me of my watch." The old sailor's aspect was very threatening. Satillo saw himself cut off from the table on which his saber and revolver were lying. "I demand restitution and apologies," Mitchell thundered at him, quite beside himself. "F from you." "Yes, from you." For the space of a second or so the colonel stood with a perfectly stony expression of face. Then, as Captain Mitchell, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.